Welcome to episode 15 of the Arcade Age podcast, this one all about Qbert. So Qbert's story begins with what should be a familiar story at this point, which is a pinball and jukebox manufacturer and vending machine company seeing that this video game thing is becoming popular and wanting to switch and in the early 1980s to develop arcade and electronics divisions and a coin-op business to build arcade games to cash in on the new arcade craze. We're going to talk about one of these companies, which is D. Gottlieb and Company, or later just Gottlieb. Founded in 1927, it's one of the founders of the coin-op amusement industry. First successful coin-op pinball machine was called Baffle Ball in 1931. 50,000 units are made. Eventually, they're purchased by Columbia Pictures in 1976, and then Coca-Cola Company, through Columbia, in 1983. They're renamed the Gottlieb Milestar, M-Y-L-S-T-A-R, Electronics. The names are pretty much interchangeable. We're going to be talking about them like they're interchangeable for now. But Milestar is short-lived in 1984 after the crash of 83. Columbia closes down Milestar Electronics, and a separate group purchases their pinball assets, and the Gottlieb portion continues to make pinball machines under a different name, Premier Technologies. So the names are a little bit confusing, but that's fine. Their last pinball machine under the name Gottlieb was 1996 Barbed Wire after the Pamela Anderson movie.
The absolutely amazing
terrible Pamela Anderson movie, Barbed Wire.
Was she nominated for Best Actress that year?
She better not have been.
I think she was at the Razzies. At the Razzies she was. I'm sure she was at the Razzies.
Yeah, well, the Razzies are like the anti
Yeah, she probably deserved the Razzies award.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just like the Room or whatever.
She deserved every award that year.
I don't like these comments on Pam.
Every award for Barbed Wire.
Barbed Wire or Barbed?
It's Barbed Wire.
Okay.
Hey, it's not me speaking here. Seamus, he's a little bit better, well, you know, more well-spoken than I am on the podcast.
Well, because I'm looking at the notes and I see Barb.
Because apparently I don't know how to pronounce frustrated.
There you did it again, dummy.
And what was the other one we said earlier you couldn't pronounce? We were making fun of you earlier for something else.
There's a lot of them.
It'll come up. It's okay. We still let you on the podcast. So Gottlieb's 1965 machine, Kings and Queens, is the one that Tommy plays in the 1975 film Tommy, based on All Things the Who. Today, all Gottlieb pinball machines manufactured are under any of the various names are trademarked and owned by a company in Manor, New York, Pelham Manor, New York, excuse me, Gottlieb Development LLC.
Yeah, which is just not that far from us. It's like it's 30 minutes up from us.
Pretty close.
There's the remnants of this wonderful, great pinball manufacturer at some point in time, and the remnants are just kind of like there.
Upstate, right?
Yeah,
just in Pelham, man. Just upstate.
Just upstate.
Gotcha.
Did they start in New York at all? Because I know like Coleco is from Connecticut originally.
I think that Gottlieb starts in Illinois. I will check that for you. Right now. Yep, Chicago.
Okay.
Like Chicago Coin-Op and all the other ones and Bally Midway. Chicago is like the center of Coin-Op stuff.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Coleco is Connecticut Leather Company, if anyone didn't know. Mm-hmm. So that's where they started and how they started, I guess. So the main event with Gottlieb is really what we're going to be talking about, Qbert, which releases in 1982. It's designed by Jeff Lee, Warren Davis, and Ron Wexman. And it's a 2D puzzle game with isometric graphics, which is kind of cool for the time. It gives you a pseudo 3D effect. You're this little funny orange snorkel-nosed Qbert, and you have to change all of the cubes on your pyramid to a different color, all while avoiding enemies and not falling off the sides. Rick Teague suggests a pinball knocker for the inside of the cabinet that goes off when Qbert falls off the cube, and that is in the machine.
Yeah, it's not an ARM machine because I never installed one. An ARM machine is basically a J-Rock board. It's not an original one, but I really wanted to build a Qbert. I really wanted to have a Qbert for the exhibit, and I didn't want to spend the money that they command right now in great condition, all original. With the pinball knocker, they probably command like close to $3,000 if you're going to get a really nice one. And we were able to build ours for a fraction of the cost. So ours does not have a pinball knocker. And that was a leftover thing from pinball, right? So that was,
they just again, had a the guys in Gottlieb.
Around. Yeah, the guys in Gottlieb just screwing around being like, well, let's just put this one piece of pinball tech into this video game.
Yeah.
So the mechanism doesn't really do much. It's just, that's how like you restart your life practically?
No, it's just an effect. It's just an effect. Oh. It's literally just an effect inside the cabinet in all the original Q-berts. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just when you die, it just goes...
I gotcha.
Yeah. Feel it and stuff. Talking about the design for a second. So Jeff Lee designs Q-Bert in this stack of cubes on the screen. And one of his inspirations is the artist M.C. Escher, who you've all seen stuff from him. Those are those sort of infinite staircases, and he has these sort of weird optical illusion kind of designs that he makes. And
yeah, and he does it all like mathematically, doesn't he? Like it's
I think
all,
so.
Yeah, which I've always found fascinating.
Yeah,
in
like,
regards to his artwork.
There's the spiral one where the spiral connects to itself in that weird way. It's like a mathematical parabola or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So, if you look at the design with that kind of in mind, you kind of see it because it's not really an optical illusion, but it does have these weird kind of funky curves and stuff like that.
Yes, it does.
Look weird. So the original version of the game is called Snot and Boogers.
Yeah.
Which is a great title. Where do they get the name Q-Bert from then?
It's in the show notes a little bit later on.
Okay.
You'll see it.
We'll get to it. Warren Davis, who's a recent hire to Gottlieb, sees what is being created and wants to kind of get involved with it and tweak it and play with it a little bit. He changes it from the shooting theme where it was initially you were jumping on blocks and shooting bullets as a projectile from your elephant trunk nose that Q-Bert has. He changes that, and he goes along to kind of a strategy, almost pseudo-puzzle game type of thing.
I would say it's definitely a puzzle.
To the plot now, Ron Wexman is also involved, where he suggests the blocks changing color when the player jumps on them. So that's the two that sort of are involved in that. Richard Tracy at Gottlieb, in a meeting, suggests that the character's name as a cross between Cube and Hubert. So that's where Q-Bert comes from.
Yep.
Okay.
Cube Hubert, which also would have been a great name. Cube Hubert.
If you could, you know, let it roll off the tongue properly. Yeah.
Right. No, that's the best part is it doesn't roll off the tongue at all.
Exactly.
It's the worst combination of words. Q-Bert's enemies are these funny little things. They're not really that intimidating, and they all have funky names.
Yeah.
Like there's the snake Coily, the gremlins are named Ugg and Wrong Way, and the little imps are called Slick and Sam, who none of the enemies really, do they do anything to you? I think the snakes do, right?
Yes.
Some of them do, but most of them.
Slick and Sam do not go after Q-Bert. I think Slick and Sam change the blocks back to the original color, and they're just there to like really annoy the living crap out of you.
Right, to just mess you up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when that happens, Q-Bert gets, if I may bring it to a PG-13 level, he gets fucking angry.
Yeah.
He gets very angry.
Yeah, he curses.
Yeah,
he
does. We'll get to that, yeah.
Well, you get one in a PG-13. It's okay.
Yeah. You get one in a PG-13.
Okay, but it's out.
So no Lee more. And the sound and engineer, David Thiel.
David Thiel, yeah.
David Thiel. Give Q-Bert that distinctive voice and personality, and just like Zach was mentioning, when an enemy catches Q-Bert, he falls over the edge, and there's a trailing scream followed by a thud. The other times that Q-Bert gets hit, he mutters this angry gibberish with word balloons appearing above his head, which are just symbols implying that he's cursing.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the sound chip is actually from a pinball soundboard. So it's an Amos Technology 6502, 894 kilohertz, and coming out of a pinball machine.
And the speech bubbles, believe it or not, I don't know if you guys are aware of this or not, but they actually like made a language for Q-Bert, and they have a name for Q-Bert's language. Could we take a guess?
Q-Bertese?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it really?
It was a complete Q-Bertese guess.
Yeah, Q-Bertese. He understands English, supposedly, but he speaks Cubanese.
Right. Is it a derivative of other any other languages outside of outside of English? Like, I know if anyone's ever seen or played The Sims is something similar where they derive the language from a bunch of different languages, and then they make their own language from it.
Yeah. Simlish,
but with
right?
just sounds of gibberish and other things. Yeah. And what's the other one? Oh yeah, it's the Minions. The Minions language is actually, even though it's a bunch of gibberish, is derived mostly from Spanish.
And is it really?
Yeah, you can actually hear a lot of Spanish sounding words in that language.
Well, David Thiel's, I got a quote from David Thiel about the speech from Ultimate History of Video Games, a book I reference all the time. He says, I had been tasked with using this speech chip that was on a pinball soundboard. It was really unpleasant task because the technology was crummy. You had to manually put together the units of speech, these little sounds, and try to make it say things. It's not the same as joining letters together on paper and ending up with words. We wanted the game to say, you have gotten 10,000 bonus points. And the closest I came to it after an entire day of working on it would be bogus points. Being frustrated with this, he says, well, screw it. What if I just stick random numbers in the chip instead of all this highly authored stuff? What happens? And he says, it sounded alien. It sounded like somebody should be able to understand it. But of course, you couldn't understand it because it was gibberish. By that time, Warren had Qbert bouncing around on the cubes. And he basically says to Warren, have I got something for you? And then there, the Qbert language, Cuberese, is born, this gibberish.
So it's a speech synthesizer, but it's just jamming random phonemes together, basically
yeah, because the tech he's working with is out of a pinball and it's really just junk,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
I've always loved those speech synthesizers. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to play with one and just make it like make random noises.
Yeah,
I wish I could find like an emulator on the computer.
You probably can dig deep enough.
I still have to look.
If you get good enough, we know what developer you could work under.
David Thiel. Okay. Give him a call. I'll make it say you have gotten 10,000 bonus points.
Bonus or bogus?
Bogus points. Ah. Same thing.
And what year are we talking about right now with Qbert?
We are talking about release in the arcade, October 18th, 1982.
Oh. Yeah, I didn't do my usual this year in the world.
The historian didn't do his job.
No, you're right. You're right. I can give you one, though. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, released in 1982.
I made a mistake.
Here we go.
Star Trek.
Jesus with the Star Trek II reference.
Welcome to another episode of the Star Trek podcast.
Holy crap.
Stop.
So Qbert is actually a massive success for Gottlieb, and they end up selling a total of 25,000 machines. And they end up getting tons of licensing deals, as we've talked about, with other game mascots for lunchboxes, board games, and Qbert gets his Saturday morning cartoon as well. And it's one of the highest grossing arcade games of 1983. At the 82 AMOA show, it's a huge hit, and Video Games Magazine says about that game, no operator dared to walk away without buying at least one. Meaningly, at the Gottlieb Milestar booth, everyone's crowded around this game, everyone's in love with it, and everyone's going home with purchasing one for their arcade. Electronic Games calls it the most innovative coin-op game of the year that year, and Edge magazine attributes Qbert's success to Qbert because he swore. Obviously, he's swearing. He's this foul-mouthed little furry snorkel-nosed dude.
Elephant-nosed munchkin.
And that players could relate to a character swearing out of frustration, or as Zach says, frustration.
Yes. Thank you.
By the way, the whole 37 episodes of the Qbert cartoon are on YouTube, full episodes. So
really?
I was going
you'd
to
like to check
that.
Those out.
Do you remember the TV show at all, Seamus? Have you watched it before?
I recall maybe commercials for it, but I don't recall ever watching it.
Yeah, I wonder what it was like.
Yeah.
It's probably the weirdest thing you've
ever seen. You can find on YouTube now.
Yeah.
This is true.
Again, you got 10 minutes to watch an episode of the Qbert cartoon show.
I would assume the show feels like a fever dream.
Oh, I mean, the game feels like a fever dream. So.
Yeah, like it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Might be a good Adult Swim show.
Yes. Yeah.
Qbert is basically Mostar Gottlieb's only success in video arcades. You know, they put out a couple other games. They put out like a part two called Qbert's Cubes. They put out another game called Mad Plants, another game called Krull. They put out the Three Stooges.
Is Krull based on the movie?
I don't know.
Okay.
They also put out another game, interestingly enough, called Reactor, which is kind of about like diffusing like a nuclear reactor.
Oh, I think I've seen that one.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting, cool game.
Yeah.
But they never recapture anything that Qbert had captured for them to begin with at all.
I was going to ask about that. I thought they had at least one other success.
Well, Reactor might be considered one. Maybe Mad Plants is considered one, but nothing that's gonna be as big as Qbert. I mean, Qbert is
Qbert's one of the brand classics.
Yeah, yeah, he's a brand. He's a classic. Like I mean, I said,
Pac-Man, Centipede, Qbert. You know?
Right. Like I said, he is very recognizable even today to kids. Kids of these days, just, you know, today they will recognize him. They will know his name right off the bat.
I mean, he's been listed in a lot of other media. Laundry list of references in other media. I mean, I can go into that entire section. You know, he's been played by Robin Williams. He was in probably the biggest reference that we get here at the museum is Wreck-It Ralph. I mean, even just looking at the cabinet alone, like you see the cabinet, if you've ever seen the cabinet, if you haven't seen the cabinet, it is a bright yellow with a nice black, background, black backdrop that kind of catches the eye. And his character too is bright yellow, right? I believe, or no, he's,
no,
orange.
He's bright orange.
He's orange. Yeah, he's orange. But those colors, I think it's very demanding on the eye. So it's very recognizable.
It draws you in.
Yeah, it's eye-catching.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That entire cabinet is completely eye-catching.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For its day.
Just to go through some references here, Qbert was, like I said, played by Robin Williams in the movie Moscow on the Hudson. Never seen it. 1984 film.
Moscow on the Hudson?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Qbert doesn't ring a bell, but when you have someone like Robin Williams playing or
ridiculous.
Voicing that role, it's pretty iconic. Qbert was in the Qbert arcade cabinet was referenced in Ghostbusters the video game in 2009.
Yeah.
Pretty decent game. I played it. It's an action adventure game.
That's like the best Ghostbusters 3.
Probably.
Right? It's the best Ghostbusters sequel.
It's the only
sequel.
Ghostbusters game I remember playing.
Okay.
So.
Which one?
The 2009.
Yeah.
That's the best Ghostbusters sequel.
Outside of that, though, I think Wreck-It Ralph is probably... Are we... We're
What's
really
the best Ghostbusters
right
sequel?
The game on the Xbox.
Oh.
Well, 2009, yeah. So I checks out.
This one. Okay.
I think we didn't make the proper... we're doing this very wrong today. We have a new voice here, and...
Well, it's a reintroduction. I was about to mention it, too. It's
hey,
a,
we haven't
Sean,
mentioned it yet, and I'm very
Sean
upset.
Is literally back from, like, a... Two or 3 month hiatus.
Yeah. The depths of hell.
the depths of marriage hell.
Well, college
and college
marriage,
as well.
College and marriage.
And all of a sudden, he just like wakes up.
Just
and he's
pops
like,
in
yeah.
and starts talking about Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah.
Just college and marriage. Qbert. Two things I never thought would go together.
Yeah.
There you go.
They
the
did.
Return of Sean.
Have any of you played any of the ports for Qbert?
The ports?
Yeah. I mean, it was ported like everywhere, right? I mean, it was ported. Intellivision, Atari 2600, Atari 5200, the Commodore 64, the VIC-20, ColecoVision. The Atari 2600 port, like most Atari 2600 ports, is absolutely shit.
I think I've seen it.
Fuck, it sucks.
It's shit.
Yeah.
Because isn't that the one with the black backgrounds around Qbert?
Yeah.
Because they couldn't figure out the sprites.
It's awful.
Which, by the way, it's just laziness and poor programming because people have done homebrews of Qbert on the 2600. It looks fine.
Really?
Yes. You can look it up, like homebrews of it that people have reprogrammed. It looks decent. It's not great, but it looks fine. And again, just like we talked about with Pac-Man, the 2600 port, there's nothing... I mean, the 2600 is kind of archaic even by the 70s or the 80s. But the Pac-Man port also shows you Ms. Pac-Man on the 2600 looks much better than Pac-Man. A lot of the reasons the 2600 games are awful is because of laziness. Because they figured whatever we put out, people will buy it.
When it was released, Video Games Magazine warned that buyers of the Atari 2600 version may find themselves just a little disappointed. They criticized lack of music,
just a little.
The removal of characters arguing wrong way, and the system's troubles handling the character sprites at a steady performance. So, literally, yeah, it was just crap. Again, thank you, Atari 2600, for taking something beautiful and really making it quite rubbish.
Should have gotten an Atari 800. Looks great in the 800.
The fuck's an Atari 800?
It's a computer.
It's a computer.
Oh, yeah.
It's the Atari.
It's part of the computer family, yeah.
What? That's what we were talking about last episode. Everyone made fun of me. Well, I can play Q-Bert.
Yeah, whatever, Tom Hanks.
And exactly. They put it back out in the 5200, which I'm not sure if that was any better at all, Chris.
I haven't seen it.
So, I mean, as we were talking before we started the podcast about Atari consoles in general, they kept trying to basically put out the same games from the Golden Age across each platform that they built and designed across 2600, 200, and 7800.
Yeah, and especially once you get to the 7800, I mean, it's competing with the NES. So you're playing, like, do you want Pac-Man or The Legend of Zelda? It's like, okay.
Yeah, and they put up 7800 right around the time NES is out, and then Master System comes out a little bit later or whatever.
Right.
And NES is obviously the big boom at that time, and the 7800 is almost last gasps, right, of Atari. But when it's put out, you basically all but see it completely disappear from store shelves at that time as it's going up against the Nintendo Entertainment System.
So let's talk more about Gottlieb. So they don't have any more arcade successes, really. Are there pinball successes that they have after this? I know the pinball is sort of half and half at this point. It's not like the heavy hitter it was in the 60s and 70s, but what are some other like high-end, high-hitting pinball machines? Do they have any others? Or is Gottlieb like a one-hit wonder?
No, Gottlieb is definitely not a one-hit wonder. They definitely have plenty of pinball. I'm just going to have to look it up real quick.
In the arcade, though, they are. In the arcade, they're definitely a one-hit wonder.
In the arcade, in the video arcade, they are definitely a one-hit wonder, yes. Yeah. As Electromech goes, they continue to produce pinballs after the video game crash. But their pinball machines go on, as we said, until the 90s with barbed wire.
The classic.
Barbed wire.
Barbed.
They have Black Hole in 1981. They have Haunted House in 1982. They continue to do pinballs 84 and 85. They have a Chicago Cubs triple play pinball in 1985. They have other ones called Monte Carlo, Big House, Robo War, all in the 80s, late 80s, 88, 89, Excalibur, Bad Girls, Hot Shots. So they're still putting out substantial amounts of pinball up until, like I said, the 90s. They actually did the, based on the Stargate movie, they did the Stargate pinball, and they actually are, and I have played it, responsible for the Shaq Attack pinball in 1995, which is Shaquille O'Neal's pinball.
There we go. Now we're talking.
They also did a Nightmare on Elm Street pinball in 1994. And in 1995, they did a pinball for what is considered the worst movie ever made, which is Kevin Costner's Waterworld.
I think you mean the greatest movie ever made.
So they do a pinball, Waterworld, which is their pinball number 746, apparently, in 1995.
Okay.
Same year they released a Mario Andretti pinball.
Okay.
And then their last one is the only one that they do in 1986, which is barbed wire.
Okay. So they have quite a bit of success,
I think, in pinball. Yes, but Milestar goes away after 1984.
Right.
Technically.
And so was that their electronics division? Okay, so once Milestar leaves, do they really even try past 84 to release anything? video game related, or are they just in the pinball at that point?
Well, they basically do... No, their last one is a game called Curveball in 1984, I believe. They got into the Laserdisc craze in 83 and 84 with a game called Mach 3, another game called Us Versus Them. And their license, their big licensed game with an IP is Three Stooges, and that was, they published that in 1984. I've never seen that game.
Is that the NES game?
No, that was an arcade game.
Wait, that was an arcade game? Oh.
It was an actual arcade game. And it's the Milestar board that we have in our Q-Bert actually has Three Stooges on it. It has all of that, has the majority of their supported video games on that board, on that J-Rock board, much like our, you know, Williams board sets from Milestar, or from J-Rock do. So Mad Plants is on that, Reactor's on that, Crawl's on that, Screw Loose, and Three Stooges, but they don't have any success with anything else besides Q-Bert. They're kind of like one and done at that point.
The games that came after Q-Bert, were they like games that had the same concept or platform as Q-Bert, or were they all kind of...
I think they're very, very different. That's, you know, they followed Q-Bert with Q-Bert's Cubes to try and keep cashing in on it. But
everything else was its own little concept.
Yeah, everything else is its own concept. And Q-Bert is an unusual game, right? I mean, the isometric view of it is unusual. The entire character development is unusual, but it's just unusual enough for people to really fall in love with it and really be drawn to it. And like as you guys were saying earlier, that cabinet is just an eye catcher. You know, and the character on the side of the cabinet is beautiful. You know, you see it and you know what the game is about. You know, you can look at other side art for other games of that era and be like, I really don't know what this game is about until you... But you get, like, that's Q-Bert on the side art, and I'm doing that. I'm jumping on those blocks. The side art tells you what you're doing in the game, which is, I think, also part of the attraction.
It goes back to the idea that, you know, all these classic arcade games that we have had in the past, from, you know, Millipede, Centipede, Q-Bert, the list goes on. They're very easy to pick up on, very easy to play, but they're hard to master.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting thing about Q-Bert 2 is that the joystick is set at a 45 degree angle. So it's not set regular, so it's set in diamond. So it's inset diamond, but it's still four way.
That makes sense with the pyramid scheme, right, too. So you can kind of control which way you're going.
When we were putting ours together, I was like, it says, four way joystick. And I put it in the, you know, the normal way. And I'm like, wait a second, this isn't playing right whatsoever. So I had to, like, you know, Dremel out the proper, you know, seat for it, and then get it reseated again. I was like, oh yeah, this is on this. That makes sense that this is on an angle.
Yeah.
Going back to the, you know, more modern day references, because I think when we talk about Q-Bert here, I had never heard of Q-Bert before working here. Never heard of it. I mean, I'm a 26-year-old adult male. Okay. Never in my life heard of this game. I didn't grow up in the arcade like a lot of people your age did. That was a little past my time. I was more a console kid. But it was weird to me to start working here and having kids 9, 10, you know, even younger, say, "Do you guys have Q-Bert? Do you guys have Q-Bert?"
Yeah, they knew who it was. Yeah.
I'm like, what in the hell is Q-Bert?
Right.
And so I had to look it up, and I'm like, how the hell do these kids know what Q-Bert is? And then I found out later, you know, popularized by Wreck-It Ralph. There was a movie in 2015 that came out called Pixels that starred, like, Kevin James.
The Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, it was an Adam Sandler-produced movie. Didn't do well, but, you know, I think still had somewhat of an impact on, you know, the...
Is Q-Bert in that?
He is referenced in that movie.
Interesting.
Q-Bert's a he? Yeah?
I think so.
Not gender. I don't know. We don't have to go into the politics of that for a second.
Trying to gender.
But I guess some other, you know, other references to help out with those modern day the modern day knowledge of Q-Bert. There was a commercial in 2014 by Radio Shack.
Oh,
surprise,
I think I
Radio Shack
one.
Was still around in 2014.
Yes, yeah. I think I remember.
For the Super Bowl 53. Sorry, no, Super Bowl 48. The 80s called. Haven't seen that commercial, but I will go watch it after this. But it's weird now because now if I see Q-Bert, I'm like, oh, there's Q-Bert. He's just iconic now, which is so weird because he was not
for
a
you
long
before
time.
before you arrived here.
Oh yeah,
working here, right?
Oh yeah. Just a little aside. One of my favorite streamers is Jacksepticeye. I don't know if anyone knows who Jacksepticeye is. Jacksepticeye is a philanthropic gamer streamer. He's around our age, I think. He is very, very Irish.
Yeah.
Got a nice brogue going. He also shares my name. His first name is Sean.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen a couple of streams.
And he played Q-Bert in the 2021 film Free Guy. If anyone's seen Free Guy, Free Guy is it's Ryan Reynolds. He plays an NPC character come to life in a GTA type of world. It's actually a really good movie. It sounds horrible, and the trailer for it, not appealing.
It's
at
awful.
All. But the movie, I watched it. I actually watched it my bachelor party weekend.
Okay.
With my boys.
Interesting.
Okay.
It was really good. It was actually really good. Surprisingly good.
And Q-Bert is played by
Q-Bert
an Irishman.
Q-Bert is referenced in that movie, played by Jacksepticeye.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was recent too. That's just last year.
Yeah.
So. Real quick, I just want to go into the high scores. I know we don't really talk about high scores that often.
We have been lately.
We've talked about them.
Have we?
Yeah, okay. We have been.
So this one is, I think, a little special simply because of not who scored the high score, but where it was scored.
Okay.
If you are unaware.
Let's hear it.
The high scored, it's gone through many iterations. There was a woman, Doris, I believe her name is, scored it in the 80s. Yeah, 1984, at the age of 58, Doris Self, the oldest, considered by Guinness World Records, to be the oldest competitive female gamer at the time, died in 2006, unfortunately, scored the high score on Q-Bert in 1984. After her, there were a couple more people, but the current record holder is George Lutz. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. George Lutz. Scored the high score in 2012 in Denver, Colorado. I'm not going to go into the scores themselves because they're a little large. But my favorite part about this is that George Lutz broke a 30-year record by Rob Gerhardt in Brooklyn, New York, playing for 84 hours and 48
Jesus
minutes
Christ.
On February 14th to the 18th, 2013, at none other than our good friend, Richie Knuckles Arcade in Flemington, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Really?
Huh. Wow. Wow.
How did Richie close for 84 hours?
84 hours on
he didn't.
One
he just kept it open.
Quarter.
I guess not, yeah.
On one play, 84 hours.
We're going to have to call him about that.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to him about that.
Yeah.
Richie Knuckles is a good friend of ours.
Was it tournament settings? It had to be tournament settings.
We'd have to ask him.
I'm sure
he remembers.
84 hours?
Yes.
On one quarter.
2013, on one play. On
wow.
one play, 9 years ago.
Wow.
Dude, that's cool. That's ridiculous.
Well,
84 hours.
Another New York, Long Island connection. You said the guy who has the record now, his last name is Lutz. Isn't that the family from the Amityville Horror?
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's what I was actually going to.
Yeah, that's what I was
kind of reference.
It's spelled L-E-U-T-Z. I'm not sure if that's the same
okay.
spelling.
No, Lutz is L-U-T-Z.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine, that's why I'm not sure about the pronunciation,
George Lutz,
but
I was
going to
say, wasn't it also George?
It was also George
was like
Lutz
George
at the Amityville Horror.
Oh,
what
yeah.
is that, the original?
Well, I'm glad
like
he has
first
a different
story,
because yeah.
I know the DeFeos.
Well, no, so the Lutzes bought the house from the DeFeos.
From the DeFeos.
All right, so.
Ronnie DeFeo was the one who killed his whole family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Lutzes bought the house.
Yeah,
and the
so,
Lutzes
okay.
are the thing that stuff happened to.
Yeah.
Famously from
well
the
George congratulations I'm sorry we're tarnishing your name on
that's
no, we're not we're talking
different
completely
Lutz.
Different George Lutz
yeah different George Lutz
hopefully that's how you pronounce it
yeah
we'll find out
everybody's
one more interesting thing about just the history of all these type of electromech companies that then jump on to electronics. You know, Gottlieb is technically, if they're still kind of going in a sense, right, in Pelham Manor in a sense, but they are, you know, one of the forefathers of pinballing in America. Technically, they go back all the way to 1927. I mean, that company is 95 years old. So they are responsible for starting and pushing the pinball electromech craze to begin with in this country.
Coin-operated amusements
starting in 1931 with their Baffle Ball. That ends up being their biggest selling game, too, because it's their first successful pinball game going all the way back almost 100 years. I mean, you got, like, think about that for a company to last that long, for a founding father company of a pop culture or subculture to last that long is pretty amazing.
And I mean, I think we're a little spoiled now when we have companies like Apple and Microsoft at, you know, the top of the world, which are fairly new company, or Google, fairly new companies. But a lot of these companies have been around forever. You know, a lot of companies didn't just start in, you know, making computers or making cell phones or whatever. A lot of these companies started, again, like Coleco, Connecticut Leather Company. They made leather belts.
Yeah.
And then they transitioned into, you know.
And when we talked about Nintendo.
Nintendo made playing cards.
Right,
Nintendo
exactly.
did playing cards exactly. over 100 years ago.
Right.
They've been around for. So
exactly.
That's really a fascinating thing to see these companies change with the times in order to keep up with things.
Yeah. And you at know, this point become from, so known for a video game.
Right. You go from being making leather belts.
Yeah.
Like you said, to the ColecoVision in the 80s. You know, Atari's huge competitor at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Does Gottlieb do anything now, or are they just kind of like a holding company, kind of patent?
They're just a holding company. They're pretty much considered defunct as of 1996.
Also like Coleco.
Yep. Also like Coleco.
Yeah.
Like a lot of those companies, you know?
All right. So thank you for listening to this episode on Qbert. We hope you enjoyed this particular episode. We're very happy to have Sean back in the studio for this episode, back from his busy life.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Whenever, you're welcome anytime. That sounded more sarcastic than I was going for. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this one. Check out our other ones if you haven't, and we'll catch you again soon.
Thank you for tuning in to the Arcade Age Exhibit Podcast. I hope you enjoyed your time with our hosts, Seamus, Zach, Jake, Sean, Chris, and Jose. Tune in next week, and remember, the future is now.